You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All comments are current at the time of publication. It's a podcast that's brought to you by the barristers at One Crown Office Row, and this episode is presented by Rosalind English.
Good evening, LawPod listeners. Thank you for lending us an ear over 2024. And now we bring you a roundup of what we think were the most significant cases of this past year. Some of them we will be going into in much further detail in episodes of their own in 2025, so we'll simply signpost them here. I have with me John Metzer of One Crown Office Row. You'll be familiar with him from many previous episodes. John has particular expertise in public and human rights law, inquests, clinical negligence, and inquiries. John, thank you for extracting yourself from work and family life to help us survey the past year in the courts.
It's great to be back. Thank you, Rosalind.
And joining John to discuss these important cases is my fellow presenter, Lucy McCann. Despite being a diligent and prolific podcaster, Lucy manages to fit in quite a lot of barristering across a number of fields: public inquiries, inquests, public law, and clinical negligence. Lucy, you've been busy, but that also means you have lots to tell us, so welcome as a guest rather than an interrogator on LawPod UK.
Thank you, Rosalind. I really like my annual step across the other side to be interviewed for a change.
Good. So shall we start with you, John? And I know that you have a number of cases that you want to discuss with us, starting with the case of HXA and Surrey County Council. Please, will you tell us about this important judicial decision?
Absolutely, Rosalind. Well, pedants, I have to apologise to you because judgment in this case was actually given in December 2023. But it came so late, it missed the roundup last year, and we think it's a really important decision. The claimants brought claims against the relevant local authorities on the basis that they suffered sexual or physical abuse by a parent or a parent's partner while they were children, and the local authorities had owed them a duty of care. This case went up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court held that the claimant's claim disclosed no basis on which there was a relevant assumption of responsibility by the local authorities. So the claims were struck out on the basis that there was no arguable duty of care owed. I'm going to focus particularly on HXA's case. There were two cases, and HXA I'm going to look at in detail. When we look at the facts, there is a chain of events in which essentially it looks as though there were serious deficiencies in what the local authority did. So from at least September 1993, there were referrals that were made to the local authority about the mother's inappropriate physical chastisement, verbal abuse, and lack of supervision of her children. And five investigations were conducted, and the names of HXA and her siblings were put on the Child Protection Register. And in November 1994, after having taken legal advice, the local authority resolved to undertake a full assessment with the view to initiating care proceedings, but they never actually did any assessment. They did continue to monitor the family, but on at least some occasions, no decisions or actions were taken despite ongoing concerns being reported. And then in due course, after the mother formed a relationship with a man who had been convicted of assault on his own infant son, in July 1996, concerns about this man's behaviour towards HXA and her siblings were raised with the local authority, and allegations were made, including of sexual abuse. But the authority decided not to investigate the matter. And that was partly because they had wrongly thought that no previous similar concerns had been raised about that man. Ultimately, in 2007, HXA's sister was removed from her mother's care under an emergency protection order due to further allegations, and that led to a police investigation. And in the end, the man was convicted of 7 counts of rape of HXA between the ages of 9 and 16, and he was sentenced to 14 years. And the mother was convicted of indecent assault, and she was sentenced to 9 months. So very, very serious matters. And the ultimate question for this court, because this was a damages claim against the local authority, the court needs to decide whether there was a duty of care that was owed by the local authority. And the legal principles are that even though the local authority will have relevant statutory duties, there's no action in tort for a breach of statutory duty. And what that means, said the Supreme Court, is that the court must decide whether there is a duty of care at common law by applying to the public authority the same principles that would be applied if the public authority had been a private individual. And so what is required, which the courts have sometimes referred to as the something more or the something else, is that there would have been a duty of care owed because of, for example, an assumption of responsibility had the public authority been a private individual. So the question was it arguable when considering a strikeout that there had been a relevant assumption of responsibility? But the Supreme Court said no, and these were the reasons. First of all, it found that the nature of the statutory function to carry out a child protection investigation following a referral alleging assault by the mother wasn't enough to entail an assumption of responsibility to perform the investigation with reasonable care. Then it was also held that where a local authority was investigating the matter, this wouldn't involve providing a service to HXA, the child, and rather it was conceptualised as being an investigation to enable the local authority to decide whether to bring care proceedings. It was also said that no facts were alleged from which it could be inferred that HXA had entrusted her safety to the local authority or that the local authority had accepted that responsibility. And even though the social worker had decided to take legal advice with a view to initiating care proceedings, that wasn't found to be enough because it was considered that the legal advice would have been advice to and for the benefit of the local authority. In terms of the allegation that the local authority had resolved not to investigate a report, it was said that, again, even though the report had been made by HXA, that the question of investigating that report wouldn't involve providing a service to HXA. So again, it wouldn't involve taking on an assumption of responsibility. And similarly, a failure to carry out an investigation, again, wasn't considered to be a failure to provide a service to HXA. And overall, it was held that the internal decisions to carry out Keep Safe Work and Assessment and to find out further information fell significantly short of being an assumption of responsibility to use reasonable care to protect HXA from the abuse. And so it was concluded, with reference to a previous decision called N and Poole from 2019, that there wasn't a meaningful difference between those two cases and that there wasn't the relevant assumption of responsibility. The court did, at the end of the judgment, consider circumstances in which there might be a relevant assumption of responsibility, and two particular scenarios were put forward. One is where the local authority has obtained a care order and has thereby taken on the parental responsibility for a child. And another scenario is where a child is being accommodated in respite care under Section 20 of the Children Act 1989. There will be an assumption of responsibility while the child is in respite care. The other case, YXA, so the conjoined case, involved issues surrounding that, but the case also didn't succeed because the claim related to periods in which the child was not in respite care.
So, John, this goes back to the ancient case of X and Bedfordshire Minors, and also we're going to touch upon this when we have a look at police liability in the Tyndall case, that actually we have to be reminded time and time again that public authorities who are given statutory duties do not therefore, and by dint of those statutory duties, owe a common law duty to care for the public. Is that fair, would you say?
That's exactly right. And also, I think that this case is part of a general trend in which the courts have moved against damages claims against local authorities for failing to safeguard children. So in May 2023, there was a decision in a case called AB, in which a claim brought under the Human Rights Act for failing to remove a child from its mother's care was also dismissed at a summary stage, and the appeal did not succeed against that. But I have to say, I think it's a complex issue. I think that it must be taken on case-by-case basis, but I do have some difficulties with the reasoning in the HXA decision. First of all, I struggle with the suggestion that it was said that no facts were alleged from which it could be inferred that HXA had entrusted her safety to the local authority. She was a child. It's very difficult to see what a child would be expected to do to entrust themselves to the local authority, and I'm not completely clear as to why that would be expected, because a child is unlikely to have the know-how to take a step like entrusting themselves to the local authority. And I think it could be thought that it should be on the authority, where it ought to understand itself to have assumed responsibility, to take that on. And then the other part of the reasoning that I struggle with is where it conceptualizes the question of whom the services are being provided for, because if the local authority is discharging its statutory duties to protect children, it's not exactly right, I think, to say that it's undertaking investigations and taking legal advice for its own benefit, because ultimately the people who need to be protected are surely the true beneficiaries of the advice which it's hoped will lead to the right decision. So I'm not totally sure about some of the reasoning there, but ultimately it's the Supreme Court, so I think it's going to be unlikely that that issue is going to come back on the table. And I think that it would be important for future cases for lawyers to be thinking whether they have that extra ingredient to bring a claim in negligence, such as one of the scenarios mooted by the court, or otherwise something else in the evidence to suggest that the local authority has taken on a responsibility beyond its normal duties to comply with its statutory obligations.
Yeah, John, combined with the decision in Tyndall, which was also a Supreme Court decision, I think you're right. I think for at least the time being, the trend is in one direction, and we're unlikely to have another authority at this level, which moves us away from what I think is a movement towards an incredibly high bar for people to bring negligence claims against public authorities. I mean, the decision in Tyndall, which involved the liability of police, which Rosalind said we are covering in the new year, the Supreme Court found no liability despite their observation that the police were in a serious dereliction of their public duty. So, I mean, you've gone over the case, the facts in HXA, but similarly, the police conduct in Tyndall was, to my mind, quite shocking. And so it does beg the question, what are those cases that people are going to be able to bring which test the limits of those decisions? I think they're going to be very, very difficult to bring, and people are going to have to be very, very careful about the kinds of cases that they're willing to pursue at appellate level.
Okay, so if there's a choice of actions that you can take against a local authority, and one is better than the other, and indeed one is absolutely the only one you can take because the other one doesn't work, let's have a look at judicial review, because it has sometimes been viewed as the only recourse that you can take against the bad behaviour of public authorities, except when there's a statutory appeal available. There's been an important case, a Northern Irish case, where the courts have said, well, actually, judicial review is a choice of several avenues, and the one doesn't eliminate the other. John, I think you have a view on this.
Yes, that's right. So when we were children, my sisters and I had a principle that our grandpa had in place, that he would entertain complaints that we may have in relation to decisions our parents had made, only if we'd exhausted all possible alternative remedies with them first. And judicial review is rather like that. And it's quite well known that because remedies are discretionary, if you can get your remedy somewhere else, then you should do so. It's seen as a remedy of last resort. My old law lecturers used to say that judicial review remedies are residuary in character. But the McLean decision actually give some nuance to that, because in the end, as we'll see, the Supreme Court was prepared to find that despite potential alternative options for the claimant, it was permissible for her to bring the judicial review. In this case, the claimant suffered from alleged headaches, nausea, and stomach problems caused by odours and noxious gases that were emanating from a landfill site near her home, which were also said to have caused mental health problems because it required her to be shut up inside and not able to use the garden, and it was difficult for her grandchildren to come over. So she brought a complaint to the regulatory bodies, which were the City Council, the Northern Ireland Environment Agency, and the Northern Ireland Department of Agriculture, Environment and Rural Affairs, and requested that they exercise their powers to take action to require the site operator to manage the site more effectively and eliminate the emissions. She was unsatisfied by their responses, so she commenced judicial review proceedings. And in reply, the defendants argued that the claimant had adequate alternative remedies. And it was said that there were two different avenues which she could go down and should go down before pursuing the public authorities in JR. First, it was said that she could bring a private prosecution for nuisance, and a statute specifically permitted this. As an alternative also, it was said that she could bring a civil action for common law nuisance against the site operator to obtain damages via that route. The Court of Appeal had looked at the case and had found there to be suitable alternative remedies, and also had found that there were conflicts of evidence between each side's experts that would need to be tested by the court in cross-examination, which was said not to be appropriate for judicial review. It was also said that insofar as she wished to complain about the conduct of the public regulators, she could complain to the Ombudsman. So the case went up to the Supreme Court, but her appeal was unanimously allowed. It was held that those two alternatives were not suitable alternatives. What the Supreme Court did was that it started by saying that the Court of Appeal had taken the wrong approach when it had said that findings of fact would need to be made about, for example, whether the odours emanated from the site, and that there was that conflict of expert evidence that would need cross-examination. Because the Supreme Court said the role of the reviewing court in judicial review is to evaluate the quality of the information available to the defendants to assess the lawfulness of the conduct. So there wasn't a factual dispute which needed resolution. They didn't rule out the possibility that in judicial review you can have factual evidence, you can have cross-examination, but it's not normal to have that. They said that that mistaken appreciation of what the judicial review would need to look at affected the assessment of the availability of an effective remedy, because the Court of Appeal had felt that a civil claim for nuisance or a private prosecution would be better suited for the claimant's objectives and be fairer, because it would be conducted as a trial and there would be a dispute of fact that would be resolved. However, the Supreme Court said, first of all, that was a misapprehension, and then also that while the claimant's overall objective was that the noxious gases be prevented from escaping from the site, her immediate aim was to compel defendant regulators to fulfil what she maintained were their public law duties, and judicial review was appropriate for that. And going against the site operator would not address the issue of the conduct of the public authorities. In this regard also, there was no statutory right of appeal against those authorities. The Supreme Court also noted that judicial review was likely to involve less time and cost than a private prosecution or a nuisance claim, and so it wouldn't be reasonable to expect the claimant to take on that burden. And I think this was important, that a private prosecution wasn't capable of giving the claimant a remedy that was as extensive as what she was seeking in the judicial review, because she was claiming partly under Article 8 of the Human Rights Convention, partly under Article 8 of the European Convention, and seeking compensation for past losses, which in a private prosecution a court wouldn't be able to award, and that even though a nuisance claim could lead to an order for damages for past losses, this wouldn't be the same as the order that she might get against the defendant regulators. The quantum would be different and the paying party would be different. Now, I think that point about the paying party being different is important, because I think what the court is pointing to is that there is a qualitative difference between who your defendant is. I think the court is sensitive to the idea that it matters who your defendant is in terms of obtaining justice against them, and that the claimant regarded herself as being the subject of an injustice by those public authorities. And even if it was true that the noxious gases was her real problem, she did also have this other issue that she was not content with the way that the public authorities had managed her complaint. That, I think, the Supreme Court felt was a reasonable and important point. And then finally, as to the Ombudsman, its role is intended by Parliament to supplement, not to replace, control of the public authorities through judicial review. So again, that wasn't a suitable alternative remedy. So I guess the takeaway point here is that if a defendant raises a suitable alternative remedy argument in a judicial review, the court should scrutinise carefully whether it truly is a suitable alternative remedy by comparing and contrasting what you can get from each avenue, and whether it represents a reason that the discretion to give a remedy in judicial review should not be exercised in the claimant's favour.
I guess, John, the hope is that, well, the outcome of this may be that public bodies make their own complaints procedures or equivalents more robust. So they have to go back and look at what they can meaningfully offer people who complain to them in the hope of avoiding judicial review claims. And that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah, that's definitely the hope. That's what we hope as lawyers.
I think whilst we're talking about the right kind of legal avenue and the right kind of defendant, this is rather different to what we've been discussing. But we might have a look at a recent case on assisted dying. Now, of course, there has been a huge movement now in the legislation regarding assisted dying. But the case of Philip Morris, which involves Section 2 of the Suicide Act and the forfeiture rule under the Forfeiture Act 1982, which is where a family of somebody who's been escorted to assisted dying in Switzerland is prone to having their assets confiscated under the Forfeiture Act. In theory, in principle, though not in fact, it's still a possibility. It's still technically there. It's a danger. And I just wondered, at the cusp of this case having been decided quite recently and the massive change in the law, Lucy, you'd be prepared to talk about the recent case of Philip Morris?
Yes, Rosalind, you're right. Assisted dying has proved to be quite a major topic, both in Parliament and our courts this year. And you're also right to identify that the genesis of all this controversy is Section 2 of the Suicide Act 1961. Section 2 provides that a person who aids, abets, counsels, or procures the suicide of another or attempt by another to commit suicide shall be liable on conviction or indictment to imprisonment. So, in line with this statutory provision, in theory, anyone who assists someone to take their own life potentially commits a crime. The picture is somewhat different when you consider the European jurisprudence on assisted suicide. And we don't have time to go through all of those decisions. I think this is worthy of an entire LawPod episode. And I hope in the next year, once we've got a bit more clarity from Parliament on the bill, that this can be a subject of a future episode. But importantly, following the Supreme Court decision in Nicholson, both the courts and the Director of Public Prosecution have found that both a person's right to life under Article 2 and their right to autonomy over their own body under Article 8 encompasses a right to end one's life at the point of one's own choosing. But importantly, the Supreme Court in Nicholson didn't go as far as making a declaration of incompatibility under the Human Rights Act in relation to Section 2 of the Suicide Act, because they considered that this was such an important ethical issue that really only Parliament could address this. You know, that's where we are at the moment. And I think it's a very interesting and important point that MPs are considering. So that's the current position. And the case of Philip Morris, as you referred to earlier, Rosalind, is one which kind of highlights the current legal complexities that surround assisted dying and ultimately the uncertainty with the position. And so it's my hope that whatever emerges from the parliamentary debate around this issue, that there will be greater clarity whichever way it lands. So the case of Philip Morris, Myra Morris was sadly diagnosed with multiple system atrophy, which is a rare and degenerative neurological disorder, sadly with no known cure, and it caused her to be in constant pain. It was her wish to have an assisted death facilitated by travelling to a clinic in Switzerland. And in light of that wish, she wrote a letter to her solicitors saying that this is what she wanted and that it was her hope that no one would get in trouble as a result of her wish to do this. Her husband, Philip Morris, considered that his wife's wish was, in his words, horrendous, but ultimately she persisted and with great reluctance he agreed to travel with her to Switzerland to assist her. And this case in particular considers the kind of secondary consequences of the criminality associated with that act. So we know it's criminal under Section 2, but what are the knock-on consequences of that? Well, in this case, as you say, Rosalind, it related to the Forfeiture Act. Myra had made a will in December 2021, and her husband, Philip, was the main beneficiary of that will. But under the Forfeiture Act 1982, a person is precluded from acquiring any benefit if they are found to have unlawfully killed another. So given Section 2 of the Suicide Act, the question was whether, by accompanying his wife Myra to Switzerland, he forfeited his right to his inheritance. The court concluded that the Morris family, both Philip and their children, be granted relief from the consequences of the Forfeiture Act. And there are some important observations that the court made in reaching this conclusion. Firstly, that Myra had capacity to make the decision to end her own life under the Mental Capacity Act, and her informed decision-making was pivotal to the ruling. In the court's words, Myra had made a voluntary, clear, settled and informed decision with the assistance of a solicitor who interviewed both Myra and Philip separately about this. The court also pointed to Philip's conduct. Initially, he sought to dissuade her from travelling to Switzerland, but he acted wholly out of compassion for his wife, so that was an important consideration. The court also found that his actions couldn't be characterised as minor assistance. They didn't seek to sort of minimise what he did, but in the round, they said his actions didn't indicate any enhanced level of legal culpability. And finally, Philip reported everything to the police and offered to assist them in making inquiries into the circumstances of Myra's death. The police ultimately took no further action. And so the court, in applying the public interest factors that one would consider when considering whether to prosecute someone, they concluded that taking all those factors into account, there were no public interest factors that applied in this case. So I think it's a welcome decision. I think it's a just decision, but it really does highlight how uncertain and complex these situations are. And ultimately for any family that's going through something like this, they have no certainty about the potential consequences that might face them if they decide to go along with a relative's wishes to have an assisted death. So it's both a welcome decision, but it doesn't really take us any further with the implications for the Suicide Act.
What you say is precisely where we're at. We actually need certainty in the law. It's no good having discretionary decisions made ad hoc like this. And I keep reminding everybody of an intellectual titan of the High Court, Sir Stephen Sedley, retired judge himself suffering from Parkinson's, who wrote recently in the London Review of Books that a dependent who helps a patient die may escape prosecution because of the DPP's guidelines, but may end up penniless because of the Forfeiture Act. In principle, the law continues to treat as a criminal anyone who, albeit out of compassion, provides the assistance needed by someone in unendurable pain to die. So let's hope that when this bill makes its way through Parliament, somebody thinks of dealing with the Forfeiture Act as well. Thank you, Lucy.
So let's look at the bill briefly. So the Terminally Ill Adults brackets End of Life Bill that's currently making its way through Parliament sets out a few things. So firstly, the bill proposes that individuals must have mental capacity to make the choice to have an assisted death and must be deemed to have expressed a clear, settled and informed wish free from coercion and pressure. An individual must be expected to die within 6 months. There must be two separate declarations, both of which witnessed and signed about their wish to die. Two independent doctors must be satisfied that the person is eligible under the bill, and the decision needs to be subject to judicial approval. Doctors can prepare the lethal substance, but the person themselves has to take it, which distinguishes assisted dying from euthanasia. And doctors are under no obligation to be involved. And I guess for inquest practitioners, of interest to me at least, is that deaths wouldn't need to be investigated by a coroner if they're carried out lawfully under the proposed bill. So there are countless interesting legal questions, I think, that arise from the bill. And there's a lot of fantastic commentary on the UK Human Rights blog about this, which I would urge our listeners to read.
Yeah, it's a really interesting time. There's an interesting aspect of this as a coincidence as well, that the DPP who promulgated the guidance after the Nicholson case on prosecutions was, of course, Keir Starmer, who is now the Prime Minister, though this is a private member's bill. I would imagine that now that Parliament has accepted, it seems, the principles underlying the bill on that vote, that there's going to be some work now to try and get the structure exactly right for how it's going to work in practice. I'm expecting that there'll be debate about this provision that deaths won't need to be investigated by a coroner, because there's been some commentary that says that it would be better if they are still investigated by a coroner, so that you can then make sure that the authority that was granted to carry out the assisted suicide was actually complied with after the fact. So I wonder if there'll be scrutiny on that. And then also, I think there's going to be discussion about how the system should work in terms of getting the approval of the courts. Jake Richards MP is quite heavily involved in this bill, and he was a successful barrister before being elected to Parliament. And he's been talking about how now that the bill has gone to its next reading, there's going to need to be a look at getting the actual practical structure right, because we need to find a balance between ensuring that there's proper judicial scrutiny, but also not creating too much pressure on the system.
Yeah, absolutely, John. And one of the issues that I think really needs to be bottomed out is how we're going to avoid adding even more pressure to an already incredibly pressurised judicial system. This was a subject of a previous LawPod episode that I did on deprivation of liberty approvals within the family division of the High Court. If there are hundreds or thousands of approval requests every year, I just can't see how the current judicial system will have capacity to deal with this. And these are incredibly important decisions. There are also, I mean, so many other things to consider in terms of the judicial approval process. I mean, will we hear from trusts, interveners? Will there be a role for the official solicitor if there are capacity issues? Will they hear extensive oral evidence? I know that the proposal is that they will hear from a clinician involved in the decision, but it's unclear how extensive that will be. And also there may be other issues about legal aid, how people can access these approval decisions. So lots to think about, and it may well be a future aspect of our public/clinical negligence practice, if that's something to be considered by clinical negligence practitioners.
So whilst we're talking about a right to die with dignity, let's go back to another obviously major protected right under Article 2 of the Convention, which is the right to respect for life, and the positive respect for life by the state. John, you have a case to discuss with us, which is Samet and Next Steps Healthcare Limited.
Yes. So Paul Samet suffer from chronic and enduring schizophrenia, and he spent some large parts of his adult life being held in hospital under the Mental Health Act. But he had a best interest review and he was moved from a secure hospital to a nursing care home. This nursing care home was operated by a private healthcare provider. And while he was there, he was treated as a person subject to deprivation of liberty safeguards. But actually, for most of the time, the deprivation of his liberty wasn't legally authorised. He died, and the medical cause of death was found after an inquest to be bronchopneumonia, large intestinal obstruction and fecal impaction relating to the side effects of an antipsychotic medication. And his family and his estate made claims in clinical negligence and breach of Article 2, the right to life under the European Convention, against both the healthcare provider and the local NHS Trust. And this case was about whether the healthcare provider was acting as a public authority such that it could be sued under the Human Rights Act under Article 2. The Human Rights Act doesn't contain an exclusive definition of a public authority, and the scheme of the Act is that you have core public authorities which are wholly public in their nature, so they always have to act compatibly with the Convention in everything they do under Section 6. Then you have other bodies, sometimes these are called hybrid authorities. Some of their functions are of a public nature, and they have to act compatibly with the Convention unless the nature of the particular act complained of is private. In this case, it hadn't been suggested that the first defendant, the healthcare provider, was a core public authority. So the question was it carrying out relevant functions of a public nature? It's important to note that the Care Act 2014 provides under Section 73 that a private care home will be taken to be exercising a function of a public nature if the care or support is arranged by a specified authority or paid for it, and the authority arranges or pays for the care under a specified statutory provision. So there are prescribed circumstances in which a private care home will be taken as acting as a public authority, but this didn't apply to Poole's case. And it was held that the provider was not carrying out functions of a public nature. First of all, the fact that his care was being funded through Section 117 of the Mental Health Act wasn't found to help his case, because funding through that avenue excludes funding through the Care Act 2014 avenue. So actually, it was felt by the court to indicate against, because he was not within the special circumstances, that was felt to actually be unhelpful, even though it was being funded through the Mental Health Act. It was found that the facts of the case were very similar to the leading case of YL, which itself had been partly overturned by the Care Act 2014 and its predecessors, but only in certain circumstances which weren't relevant here. And it was also found that the provider was not exercising powers of compulsory detention. The claimant's case had been that the provider appeared to believe that it did have such powers, but as a matter of fact, it didn't. And they were also suing in false imprisonment, which relied on the absence of such powers. So it was felt that the fact that even though he hadn't secured authorization to deprive Poole of his liberty, overall, it was held that the provider was simply carrying on business which happened to have, in the abstract, some social utility, but it was doing so for a profit. So the Article 2 part of the claim was struck out. In terms of the takeaway points, first of all, it's still settled law in the case of YL and in an older case called A, that functions of a public nature will include the exercise of the regulatory or coercive powers of the state. So if a private psychiatric hospital is compulsorily detaining someone under the Mental Health Act, it will be discharging functions of public nature. That, I think, is why it was argued that the provider thought that it had powers of compulsory detention to try to bring it within that point. So there's continuity there. If you're detaining someone under powers, even if you're a private provider, you're acting to discharge functions of public nature. But if you're not, then it won't be enough for it to be discharging functions of public nature just because it's providing publicly funded care. And it will be necessary for lawyers to look at the precise mechanism of the funding to determine whether it meets the criteria. So this, I think, is quite a rigorous decision that is making it quite clear that the requirements are quite stringent. And just because the provider is providing publicly funded care, that won't be enough for it to be discharging functions of a public nature.
So we now have a clearer picture of what constitutes a public authority for the purposes of convention claims, if we ever had. I mean, this is a saga that goes on and on. But let's have a look at publicity in a different perspective, which is where litigants, experts, and so on are involved in litigation, where anonymity orders are issued. Lucy, can you tell me about the latest litigation in that?
So the decisions that I wanted to talk about in today's episode might not be Supreme Court decisions, and they might not at first glance appear to be the best or most high-profile ClinNeg decisions. But I think for ClinNeg practitioners, they are really important and could have potentially wide-reaching consequences. No doubt the biggest ClinNeg decision of the year is the UK Supreme Court's decision in Poole, which essentially did away with secondary victim claims. But listeners will be pleased to know that we've devoted a whole episode to this, and they can be expertly guided through that decision by you, Rosalind, and Judith Rogerson. So I'd recommend that listeners give that a listen if they haven't already. So the two decisions that I wanted to highlight in this episode are the decisions in PMC and in Abbasi that both highlight issues relating to naming individuals in clinical negligence or related claims. So there's not a huge amount I want to say in this episode, partly because in PMC, that decision is likely to be appealed. And in Abbasi, we're awaiting judgment. But in very brief summary, PMC involved an anonymity application arising from a clinical negligence claim. Liability was admitted. Substantial interim payments had been approved by the court. There'd been no prior hearings because orders had been made largely by consent without hearings, but no previous application for anonymity had been made. The application was made in the context of media interest, and it's worth noting that actually the claimant had been subject to a number of stories in the public domain that identified them, and in the court's words, identified them as a high-profile victim of medical negligence. So not an ideal set of facts to bring a claim that is eventually going to be appealed, I suspect, to quite a high level. Up to this point, I think it's fair to say, John, that anonymity applications tended to be dealt with quite little contest at approval hearings and equivalents. But this issue was picked up by Mr. Justice Nicklin, who perhaps unsurprisingly has taken an interest in this issue because of his background in media law and in particular privacy law. And essentially, he has taken issue with the decision of JXMX, which for the last decade or so has been relied on by clinical negligence practitioners in all their anonymity applications. But Mr. Justice Nicklin is of the view that this authority is not consistent with principles of open justice. And so on the basis that this hasn't been explored and wasn't explored sufficiently in the case before him, he refused to grant the anonymity order requested. This is not the usual way in which courts deal with these applications. And so I suspect it's very likely that this decision is going to be considered by appellate courts, and it may go all the way up to the Supreme Court. We'll have to wait and see. But in the meantime, this will create quite a lot of uncertainty for claimants, namely on what relevant considerations are when granting anonymity applications in ClinNeg cases. For now, I think claimant practitioners will just have to be careful to warn clients about what they put in the public domain and warn them that anonymity might not be granted. I think the main lesson to take from this, pending any further decisions, is that just make an application for anonymity at the outset of your claim. Don't wait until further down the line when there might have been media interest or reporting, because to some extent, the cat's out the bag and you may find it harder to make your case for anonymity. The associated case that I wanted to talk about very briefly are the conjoined cases of Abbasi and Hastrup, which have been heard by the Supreme Court, but we haven't got a decision yet. These conjoined cases concern reporting restriction orders, which protect the identity of medical professionals involved in the care of patients in respect of whom a decision to withdraw treatment has been made. And the Supreme Court is considering whether the Court of Appeal got the balance right between Article 8 and Article 10 rights, and whether they were correct in finding that the case for protecting staff's anonymity outweighed parents' basic assertions of their right to freedom of expression in these cases. It's worth flagging that the two cases were brought by the parents of children who died having had their treatment withdrawn, and indefinite reporting restriction orders were made. There are a huge number of interveners in this case. I'm sure that many are waiting very keenly for the decision of the Supreme Court, and I'll be really interested to see which way that lands, because it could have really important implications for the other side of clinical negligence claims when advising clinicians and healthcare staff on their anonymity.
So, Lucy, and indeed John, just to wrap things up, we're talking about anonymity here, but what about the opposite, which is exposure, or some might say overexposure on social media? Let's have a look at the outcome of the Charlotte Proudman case before the Bar Standards Board. Lucy.
Yeah, thank you, Rosalind. I was trying to find a light-hearted, festive case to end our end-of-year roundup, which we always tend to find. But as I was saying in our discussions and planning of this episode, it's been incredibly hard to find a light-hearted, festive legal story to end with. I think it's probably just a reflection of the state of the political and legal landscape that we're contending with at the moment. So instead, we're going to deal with a Twitter spat, or a Twitter thread. I should refer to an X thread now, but I just can't shift the habit. I thought we'd end with the Proudman case and the disciplinary proceedings that Dr. Charlotte Proudman has been involved with against the Bar Standards Board, which will be of particular interest to barristers who listen to the podcast, but also of any professionals who are interested in disciplinary matters and their use of social media. Dr. Charlotte Proudman is a barrister. She practices in the area of family law. And in April 2022, on Twitter/X, she criticised a judicial decision in a case that she worked on. She criticised the judgment of Jonathan Cohen. Specifically, she said his judgment had echoes of the Boys Club. At the time, Cohen was a member of the Garrick Club, which was then a men-only private members club, which has obviously attracted a lot of controversy about its membership rules. Dr. Proudman also criticised the judgment for minimising the significance of the domestic abuse that her client said she faced. So she had a number of criticisms of the decision. The charges that the BSB brought against Dr. Proudman were that the tweets amounted to misconduct, were misleading, and inaccurately reflected the findings of the judge. During the professional conduct tribunal last week, all of the five charges against her were dropped and the case against her was dismissed. Nicholas Ainley, the tribunal panel chairman, found that her tweets were protected under Article 10, that her tweets didn't gravely damage the judiciary, which would put them outside Article 10 protection. And his comment was that the judiciary of England and Wales is far more robust than that. I mean, John, you may take a different view about the robustness of the judiciary, and I guess it depends in what context you come up against the judiciary. But I think it's a welcome decision. What do you think, John?
I tend to find judges who I'm in front of are very robust. Sometimes they seem a bit too robust. I think it's a good decision. I think that it reaffirms the importance of freedom of speech. And I think that what they're pointing to is that if something is going to gravely damage the judiciary, then that might be one thing. But it also has to be possible to debate the wisdom of determinations by the courts as part of the free exchange of ideas. And finding where that line is isn't easy. But bringing regulatory proceedings against Charlotte, who I do know, it must have been a very stressful thing to have gone through with one's professional practice and reputation on the line. And I think that the panel have got it right on this one because of that final point that you identify, that the courts are able to cope with robust debate around their decisions.
And it's also not insignificant and not irrelevant that Dr. Proudman has been an unfortunate victim of a lot of robustness in the opposite direction. You know, she's very high profile online and she receives a lot of commentary by other barristers, legal professionals and members of the public, some of which is in a tone that's, you know, completely misogynistic and the other side of the line. So yeah, she's no stranger to robustness. And I think that has to be a relevant consideration in this case. And I'm sure it's something that the tribunal considered.
So thank you, John and Lucy, for joining me for the survey of the year of 2024 in the courts and in Parliament. We've got many episodes coming up on subjects we've touched on, but this is the last episode from LawPod UK for 2024. So very happy Christmas and New Year, and see you in 2025.
Thank you, everyone, for listening, and Happy New Year.
Thank you very much, and wishing you all a very Happy New Year.
This episode of LawPod UK was presented by Rosalind English. The series is produced by One Crown Office Row,